Mr. Taft is full of interesting accounts of the Orient. Taft had little time to reacquaint himself with affairs in his department before he was called upon to deal with a troubling situation in Ohio. Factional disputes there threatened the re-election of Republican Governor Myron Herrick. Earlier that summer, Lincoln Steffens had published his electrifying report contrasting Democrat Tom Johnson's principled governance of Cleveland with the venal mismanagement of Cincinnati's Republican boss, Tom Cox. The piece revealed how Cox had become a millionaire twice over through corrupt alliances with traction companies, banks, and railroads. "The city is all one great graft," Steffens charged. "The reign of Cox is a reign of fear." The exposé had created a sensation in Ohio. While Cox claimed it was full of falsehoods, the tale sparked public outrage and engendered bitter conflict within the Republican Party. Those beholden to the old machines dominated by corporations and political bosses inevitably opposed the progressive drive toward popular rule and governmental regulation. The growing split within the Republicans opened the door to Democrats, who successfully likened Governor Herrick's management of the state to Cox's grip on the city. In fact, they intimated that the governor had become subservient to Cox and his crowd, a participant in the systemic graft. "The stampede from Herrick is growing like a wildfire," an Ohio paper reported. "And so consuming is the anti-Cox, anti-bossism flame that the disaffected thousands say they will vote the Democratic ticket from top to bottom this year." Believing that Ohio's gubernatorial race could influence the fortunes of the entire Republican Party, Roosevelt dispatched Taft to deliver a speech on Herrick's behalf. When Steffens learned of this step, he wrote an impassioned letter to the president imploring him not to help the governor. "Governor Herrick is not a bad man," conceded Steffens. "He is simply weak. He is one of those men who can do dishonest things honestly. State politics could not be separated from Cincinnati's municipal situation," he insisted, arguing that the growing effort to vanquish Cox, whose candidates were on local ballots that accompanied the gubernatorial election, would be thwarted by the president's push to keep Republicans in line behind Herrick. Caught in this hazardous political knot, Taft devised what newspapers called a most adroit and ingenuous speech. Voicing support for Herrick, whom he believed to be a decent man, he leveled a fierce barrage of criticism at the Cox regime. Public condemnation of Cox was not pleasant for Taft, particularly given that his brother Charlie owned and edited the Cincinnati Times, the official organ of the Cox regime. "Any pain you feel at the expressed difference of opinion between us finds a corresponding deep regret in my heart," Taft told Charlie on the eve of his speech. "For I love you, Charlie, as I love no one except my wife and children." Nevertheless, he felt bound to declare his opposition to Cox and his corrupt lieutenants. Delivered before an overflowing audience in Akron, Ohio, the speech was termed the most severe rebuke ever suffered by the powerful boss. Accustomed to criticism leveled by his Democratic opponents and the progressive press, Cox now faced censure from so prominent a Republican, a member of the president's cabinet. In straightforward language, Taft likened Cox and Coxism to a curse upon the people of Hamilton County, a local despotism designed for the financial benefit of the boss, his cronies, and the big corporations. He described the political machine's distressing effect on aspiring young Republicans who were forced to submit to the tyranny of the boss or abandon public service altogether. If he were to vote in the upcoming race, Taft acknowledged, he would vote against the municipal ticket nominated by the Republican organization. Despite his condemnation, Taft made clear the difference between Herrick, the clean-living, trusted, and honored businessman and efficient executive of the state, and the foul boss of Cincinnati. While he refused to endorse the Republican ticket in Hamilton County, Taft declared that he would happily vote for Governor Herrick and hoped others would do the same. If he believed his visit to Ohio would perpetuate the Cox machine, Taft assured his listeners, he would never have come. It would be unfair, however, to abandon a governor who has done well by his state and his party. Although Taft had sought to rally support for Herrick, Newspapers focused on his scathing denunciation of Cox, which fell upon the city and state like the explosion of a bomb. Excerpts from the speech were carried in more than 600 papers. Dozens of editorials and letters commended Taft for his honesty and courage. "We had about come to the conclusion that there wasn't a man in Ohio who dared call his soul his own without the permission of George Cox," one Ohio citizen wrote. "You are the only man who can lead this city out of the slough of despond," another remarked. "You have done more good for your own town by that speech than you have any idea of," Taft's close friend Howard Hollister wrote. "The weakness and cowardice of a great many of our principal men have been a chief trouble here, and now they are encouraged to come out and talk and act like men. I hear it everywhere." The elections that fall brought a crushing defeat for the Cox machine. But Taft's hope that voters would split their tickets, voting Democratic in the local election and Republican in the gubernatorial race, proved vain. John Pattison, the Democratic candidate for the governorship, defeated Myron Herrick by a wide margin. "Do not concern yourself about the stories that are afloat that you caused my defeat," Herrick graciously told Taft. "I know my friends, and know you to be one whom I love and respect." Buoyed by the demise of the Cox machine, young Republicans in Cincinnati formed a new Republican club with a progressive agenda. Led by Howard Hollister, they called on members to stand unequivocally against bossism and machine politics, and advocate a platform that included national regulation of railroads and tariff revision. At Hollister's request, both Taft and Roosevelt accepted honorary memberships in the Roosevelt Republican Club. Only such clear dissociation from corrupt and self-serving elements of the Republican Party, Hollister argued, could disabuse the public mind of the growing feeling of domination of the party by the corporations and money-making commercial politicians. As Theodore Roosevelt surmised, the struggle against corruption and consolidation in Ohio reflected a burgeoning movement across the country. And the president was acutely aware of the difficult balance he would have to strike in order to realign his party without compromising the nation's prosperity. In the winter of 1905, a dramatic oil war in the state of Kansas illuminated this intensifying conflict, captivating the interest of the entire country. "Kansas is in the clutches of the Standard Oil Company," the Hutchison News reported, "and is howling for relief." A year earlier, spectacular deposits that surpassed the total volume of the Pennsylvania oil fields had been discovered in Kansas and the Indian Territories in Oklahoma. On the instant, Ida Tarbell recalled, "Kansas went oil mad. Practically every farmer in the state dreamed of flowing wells." The Standard Oil Company immediately began furnishing tanks, building refineries, and constructing pipelines. Independent producers were placated with the promise that they would receive market price for their oil. Only when Standard had a total lock on refining and transportation, William Allen White explained, did the company put on the screws. A barrel of oil that had yielded $1.18 in 1904 had dropped to 37 cents a year later. With control of both in-state refineries and all the pipelines, Standard Oil had effectively become the only transporter and buyer of the region's crude oil with power to set whatever price it chose. Popular anger fueled the successful gubernatorial campaign of Kansas Republican Edward Hoke, who challenged the Republican machine with a platform calling for construction of a first-class state refinery that would force Standard to be reasonable. In his inaugural address, Hoke proposed a series of additional measures to regulate the oil trade, including one to make pipelines common carriers, rendering them subject to the same state supervision as railroads. When the upper house passed the bill for the state refinery, Standard retaliated by boycotting Kansas oil entirely, leaving the producers without a market and throwing a large number of men out of work. Standard's despotic tactics backfired when public recognition that the giant company was punishing Kansas generated such outrage that the refinery bill sailed through the lower chamber. Born on a wave of defiance, the legislation even garnered support from conservatives, who felt the measure smacked of socialism Scare Kansas? Well, we'll see about that. At the White House, telegrams poured in, urging the president to protect the state from oppression of the Standard Oil Trust. Congressman Philip Campbell of Southeast Kansas introduced a resolution requesting an investigation into the unusually large margin between the price of Kansas crude oil and the market price of refined products. It was hardly a secret, one Kansas newspaper suggested, that the situation in Kansas presented President Roosevelt with the opening he was seeking to move against the mother of all trusts. Indeed, some observers speculated that the resolution was instigated by the administration. After discussing the situation with the Kansas representative, Roosevelt announced that he had directed Bureau of Corporations Director James Garfield to make a rigid and comprehensive review of Standard Oil's methods of operation, especially in the Kansas field. Garfield planned to travel to Kansas the following month to oversee a team of 50 special agents, ensuring a thorough investigation of the trust's practices. The president clearly understood, Campbell maintained, that this was the most important investigation of the kind which has been undertaken. Although passage of the House resolution brought Standard's boycott in Kansas to an end, the fundamental problem of monopoly lingered. 2 days after the president's announcement, Ida Tarbell wrote to John Phillips, "What would you think of an article on Kansas and the Standard Oil Company?" she inquired. Having spent nearly 4 years studying Standard Oil, Tarbell remained vitally interested in the company's activities. Her 24-part magazine series had been republished as a 2-volume book the previous November to great acclaim. One critic predicted it would rank as one of the most complete and authoritative contributions to economic history written in the last quarter century. Miss Tarbell's study, another wrote, is to the present time the most remarkable book of its kind ever written in this country. The oil war in Kansas promised to furnish a new and vital postscript. When she wrote her proposal, Tarbell had returned home to Titusville to be with her father, who was suffering from stomach cancer. His death on March 1, 1905, had suddenly darkened her world, for he had built himself into every crook and cranny of her childhood home, indeed of the entire town. Her family at the magazine did their best to console her. "I have thought a great deal of you in your sorrow," S.S. McClure wrote from Switzerland when the news reached him. "There are times when your face expresses a singular pathos and sense of suffering, and I know how sad and heartbroken you have been." He hoped she found some solace in the fact that her father had seen with his own eyes how she had used her substantial gifts to dignify the Tarbell name. Not long after the funeral, Ida left for Kansas, exhibiting what McClure termed her pathetic and characteristic impulse relentlessly to immerse herself in work. Though she set out with a heavy heart, the month-long journey proved to be as exciting as any she had undertaken. Independent oilmen hailed her arrival as the coming of a prophet, certain that she would reveal Standard's unfair and illegal methods in Kansas to all the world. Local journalists trailed her throughout the state, taking her picture and printing her remarks. Embarrassed by her celebrity, she told Boyden she hoped to heaven all the foolishness published about her would not be taken seriously in the office. "Believe nothing," she entreated them, "until I have a hearing." Straight away, Tarbell called on the governor. Initially skeptical about his plan for a state refinery, she came away convinced that the project would be a good thing and serve as a measuring stick for the public to determine the real costs of refining. In the long run, however, Standard's control over oil transport had to be addressed. "Build your own pipeline," she urged the oil producers. "Build it to the seas." And in addition, she recommended that they pressure Congress to pass a law making all pipelines common carriers, subject to regulation that would ensure fair play. Soon afterwards, Tarbell joined Governor Hoke and Congressman Campbell at the biggest mass meeting of oil producers ever known. Diffident when asked to speak before 3,000 people, she composed a letter to be delivered at the convention. She challenged Kansas to play the oil game as well as the Standard Company plays it, but with due regards for the rights of men, something the Standard has never done. Following the convention, Tarbell embarked on a 10-day field trip through the countryside to gauge for herself the extent of the new oil fields. Traveling by two-horse open carriage over primitive roads, she encountered the worst dust storm in many years. Her driver, bellowing to be heard over the rising wind, roared, "Jehoshaphat, wrap your head up!" Even after the storm passed, Ida was unable to bathe for 10 days because dust had seeped into the water supply, producing a muddy liquid quite impossible to drink and hopeless for cleansing. Undeterred, she continued her mission. "The wonder is that discomfort doesn't count out here," she explained to John Phillips. All hardships were eclipsed by the contagious excitement of the farmers, by the promise that every little town would become a world's center, every well a gusher. One weekend, Tarbell crossed the Oklahoma border to see the oil fields in the Indian Territory. Everywhere she went, crowds gathered, bands serenaded her, and people gave her flowers and candy. In the new town of Tulsa, she was paraded up and down the main thoroughfare. At the request of a local citizen in Muskogee, she submitted to 5 sittings for her picture. From early morning until midnight, she was called upon to make little speeches. Needful of respite, Tarbell spent a leisurely weekend in Emporia with William and Mary White. She had taken the city-shy boy by the hand when he first ventured into New York, and had always appreciated his affection and loyalty for his state. She was delighted now to see his home, his place of work, and his beloved town. In Emporia, Tarbell agreed to address a group of students at a chapel. "The new thing which Kansas has put in the fight against the evils of standard monopoly," she told them, "is an ethical question. Here, people say they oppose standards' methods because they are wrong. Kansas was not merely motivated by the monopoly's impact on business. Standard had never met with this spirit in any of its previous fights." After her departure, White wrote an editorial, echoing her conviction that the problem with Standard Oil was as much a moral issue as it is a financial one. The machinations Standard employed, bribing legislatures, tampering with juries, purchasing judges, constituted the real danger to the country. "Yet," he concluded, "because it is a corporation and has neither soul nor body, Standard had largely managed to escape the vengeance which the law would surely have visited upon natural persons guilty of similar practices." As Tarbell passed through Kansas City on her way to New York, she stopped for a brief visit to express her gratitude and admiration for the state's spirit. She found that spirit so compelling that she extended her visit. "I stayed and stayed, and even now I am reluctant to return to the East," she later explained, describing how the nature of this fight set it apart. "The Kansans are not fighting now for the money they can make. They are not fighting because their oil doesn't market well. They're fighting because a monopoly, a trust, has sought to come into their state and dictate to them where their products shall go and what shall be paid for their products. It's the fight for justice and right." In a 2-part article, Tarbell argued that if one wants a neat demonstration, complete to the last detail, that the Standard Oil Company is today, as always, a conspiracy in restraint of trade, he should go to Kansas. There, the company continued to perpetuate exactly what it did 3 decades earlier in Pennsylvania, crushing independents, fixing prices, operating pipelines as private fiefdoms, and colluding with railroads. Her revelations produced a growing demand for official action. "If her charges proved accurate," the Wall Street Journal commented, "we take it that Commissioner Garfield will be honest enough to report the fact, and if the fact is reported, we believe that the administration is courageous enough to prosecute even the Standard Oil Company." Early on, Garfield had decided to take on the daunting task of expanding the scope of his investigation beyond Kansas to encompass Standard's methods of operation nationwide. He traveled to nearly all of the great fields and talked with hundreds of producers, refiners, and railroad men. Special agents were dispatched throughout the United States and even to Europe. Garfield's wife, Helen, was anxious about the investigation. "Do read Ida Tarbell's McClure article," she urged her husband. "It is very cleverly written. I feel that the man and those in the ring will lie to you just as she says they have lied all along." She needn't have worried. Not only had Garfield read the piece, he had borrowed Tarbell's collection of relevant sources and documentary evidence. "I shall try to find the truth," he reassured his wife. Garfield's report was published in two parts. The first concluded that Standard Oil had continued to receive the same unjust and illegal preferences from the railroads outlined in Tarbell's exhaustive series, and that these rebates, bribes, and kickbacks had facilitated development of the Trust's extensive pipeline system. The second section outlined the monopolistic position of Standard Oil in the petroleum industry. Roosevelt transmitted the first report to the Congress with a special message. "All the power of the government will be directed toward prosecuting the Rockefeller Trust." The Justice Department prepared two lines of attack corresponding to Garfield's report. The first alleged illegal rebates under the Elkins Law. The second charged conspiracy in restraint of trade based on violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. "If my report affords the basis for making these prosecutions successful, I shall be mightily pleased," Garfield wrote. While conspiracy and monopoly were difficult to prove, the rebate case promised to be relatively straightforward. Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, a colorful jurist who would later become the first commissioner of baseball, presided over the first case in which the government charged Standard of Indiana with receiving illegal rebates from the Chicago and Alton Railroad. On the day the ruling was handed down, hundreds of would-be spectators were denied entrance to the overcrowded courtroom. The ruling, which found Standard guilty of accepting rebates on 1,462 carloads of oil, required nearly 2 hours to read. Landis rendered the judgment with a series of dramatic sledgehammer blows, drawing applause on two occasions for his condemnation of Standard's corrupting influence on its employees and the nation as a whole. Never before, one court reporter noted, had a judicial sentence featured such inflamed rhetoric. While the guilty verdict surprised few, the size of the resulting fine stunned the company and the country. For each of the 1,462 carloads of oil that had enjoyed an illegal rebate, Landis levied the highest possible fine, $20,000, generating a spectacular cumulative total of $29,240,000. Commenting on the hefty charge, Mark Twain drolly remarked that the sum evoked the bride's proverbial astonishment on the morning after her wedding. "I expected it, but didn't suppose it to be so big." Ida Tarbell optimistically declared that the decision presaged the beginning of the end for the giant octopus. For 35 years, Rockefeller's corporation had absorbed small fines as the cost of doing business. This big fine, she hoped, would mark the moment when Standard must either conform to fair dealing or face ruin. Despite such predictions, John D. Rockefeller remained sanguine about his company's prospects. He was on a golf course when word of the judgment reached him. "Judge Landis," he complacently predicted, "will be dead a long time before this fine is paid." Rockefeller's prophecy was confirmed 11 months later when appeals court judge Peter Grosskopf overturned the decision on a technicality. "It's nothing more than we expected," the Standard attorney smugly proclaimed. Roosevelt publicly derided Grosskopf's ruling as a gross miscarriage of justice, further proof of too much power in the bench. His momentary frustration aside, Roosevelt remained optimistic about the administration's second and more trenchant line of attack. 6 months after the publication of the Garfield Report, the Attorney General filed suit in St. Louis, charging Standard Oil of New Jersey and its 6 subsidiaries with conspiracy to monopolize the oil industry in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Again, reports invariably cited Tarbell's work as both inspiration and template for the government's case. This time, the federal court found in the government's favor. 2 years later, in a decision that stunned the business world, the Supreme Court affirmed the lower court's ruling. The High Court condemned Standard Oil, not because it is a trust, but because it has an infamous record, and delivered a warning to every trust that is tempted to oppress and destroy. Once again, Rockefeller was in the middle of a golf game when the news arrived. Buy Standard Oil, he curtly responded. Even when the corporate octopus was divided into 38 parts, Standard Oil of New Jersey preserved its identity, eventually morphing into Exxon, Standard Oil of New York, incorporated as Mobil, and Standard Oil of Indiana evolved into Amoco. While Roosevelt exulted in each of his antitrust victories, he continued to regard the judicial system as an ineffective arena for controlling giant corporations. Regulation, he believed, promised a far better remedy. The design should be to prevent the abuses incident to the creation of unhealthy and improper combinations, he argued, instead of waiting until they are in existence and then attempting to destroy them by civil or criminal proceedings. Unlike antitrust proceedings, however, federal regulation required approval in the House and Senate, where conservative Republicans remained a dominant force. After failing to defeat the Bureau of Corporations, this reactionary bloc was determined to prevent Roosevelt from miring the party and the country in policy they considered tantamount to socialism. The fundamental idea on which our government was founded, conservatives argued, was that the functions of the federal government were strictly limited, and that all regulations which most closely affect the lives of the people should be left in the hands of state and municipal bodies. Roosevelt's regulatory ideas would extend the power of the federal government to an unlimited degree. Are we to have a national government as highly centralized as that of France or Germany? Opponents ominously queried, warning, that is what we certainly shall have if we find no way of checking the tendencies in government of which Theodore Roosevelt is so conspicuous and enterprising an exponent. Chapter 17. The American People Reach a Verdict. Increasingly frustrated in the winter of 1905 by the bickering in Washington and the rancor within his own party, Theodore Roosevelt ranted to a friend that, "There are several eminent statesmen at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue whom I would gladly lend to the Russian government if they cared to expend them as bodyguards for grand dukes whenever there was a likelihood of dynamite bombs being exploded." His sardonic suggestion targeted the coterie of conservative Republican senators who opposed his signature plan to regulate the railroads. The cost to both his party and the country would be immense, he believed, if the people at large perceived that the Republican Party had become unduly subservient to the so-called Wall Street men, to the men of mere wealth, the plutocracy. It would result in a dreadful calamity, Roosevelt told a conservative friend, to see the nation divided into two parties, one containing the bulk of the property owners and conservative people, the other the bulk of the wage earners and the less prosperous people generally. Each party insisting on demanding much that was wrong, and each party sullen and angered by real and fancied grievances. In the struggle to avert this calamitous future, nothing was more essential, Roosevelt believed, than railroad regulation. His first address to Congress following his election victory had indicated his primacy of the issue. Above all else, he declared, we must strive to keep the highways of commerce open to all on equal terms. The most critical piece of legislation the country needed was an act to give the Interstate Commerce Commission the power to regulate railroad rates that gave an unreasonable advantage to the trusts. As the battle lines formed that winter, S.S. McClure decided that the magazine's next series would concentrate on the railroads. His staff had already concluded that many of the country's gravest problems, from state and municipal corruption to the ascendancy of the trusts, could be traced to the railroads. While earlier modes of transportation, the wagon roads and waterways, had been available to all on an equal basis, a small circle of private owners now controlled the transportation network essential to all commerce. This exclusive circle could effectively determine the fortunes of cities, towns, and companies, the futures of entire industries. Both the Grangers and the populists had called for governmental regulation of the railroads. But despite the passage of the 1903 Elkins Act, the industry had remained essentially unregulated. Ida Tarbell's study of Standard Oil had convinced her that Rockefeller had employed discriminatory freight rates as the primary instrument in his campaign to crush independent competitors. Until the transportation problem is settled, and settled right, she warned, the monopolistic trust will be with us, a leech on our pockets, a barrier to our free effort. Steffens, too, had discovered that in every city and state he had explored, the story was always the same. Corruption came from the top, from the men who owned streetcar lines in the cities and railroads in the states. New Jersey's dominant railroad had seized the government, and the Southern Pacific Railroad had become the actual sovereign of California. Like his colleagues, Baker's own countrywide investigations had persuaded him that the railroad problem is pretty nearly the basic problem of our life, and we know little or nothing about it. Having completed his labor series and eager for more dragons to slay, Ray Baker was thrilled to be chosen for the assignment. By supplying the real facts, the nation's reporters shaped that essential discussion. The journalist, he passionately believed, is the true servant of democracy. This new project on the railroads, he told his father, would be far more important than anything he had ever done. Baker started by examining everything he could gather on the subject, pamphlets, congressional reports, local investigations, scholarly studies, and court testimonies. He read accounts of La Follette's titanic fight against the railroads in Wisconsin and sought guidance from experts on the railroad industry. Upon learning that Baker had begun his investigation, Roosevelt invited him to Washington. Baker promptly replied that he hoped to take up the railroad problem in some big, important, and impressive way. On January 28, 1905, Baker joined the president for a simple and most informal family lunch, after which the two men engaged in a private conversation. By this time, Baker had gained a pretty good grip on the railway problem and shared with the president a detailed outline of his planned series. Central to the series was the argument that railroads were public highways that must be accessible to all on fair and equal terms. They should no longer enjoy peculiar charter rights from the government, including the right of eminent domain and the right to charge tolls. For his part, Roosevelt was confident he could steer a bill through the House, where the members felt the direct pressure of growing agitation against the railroads. His chief trouble, he told Baker, would be the Senate, where members were sent by the state legislatures, and many owed their seats to corporate interests. His best chance lay in mobilizing the public, so the Senate could no longer refuse to act. Nevertheless, he urged the reporter to be fair. An analysis couched in demagogic rhetoric would not be trusted. My job is not to assess blame on anyone, Baker countered. I am trying to get at the facts and report them as truthfully as I can. It was altogether the most interesting meeting and talk with him that I ever had, Baker told his father. I think he likes to get these things firsthand. The president had asked Baker to consult with him often during the course of his research, promising to enable the magazine's effort to clarify the complex problem for the general public. Facilities have been given me here as never before, Baker proudly noted. The interstate commerce people even offering me a desk and stenographer, with full admission to all their published documents and letters. It certainly shows how a greater care for truth and fairness, which I have tried to attain in my articles, gets hold of people. 2 days after meeting with Baker, Roosevelt began his own campaign for railroad regulation with a major speech before the Union League Club in Philadelphia. Neither this people nor any other free people, he declared, will permanently tolerate the use of the vast power conferred by vast wealth, and especially by wealth in its corporate form, without lodging somewhere in the government the still higher power of seeing that this power, in addition to being used in the interest of the individual or individuals possessing it, is also used for and not against the interests of the people as a whole. Calling again for a public tribunal with power over rates, he argued again that only the national government could keep the great highways of commerce open alike to all on reasonable and equitable terms. Shortly thereafter, Roosevelt met with Baker for another luncheon discussion. He admonished the journalist once more to beware of demagogues, emphasizing that the web of corruption linking politicians and corporations was due quite as much to the blackmailing demands of legislators as to the offered bribes of businessmen. That evening, Baker wrote a long passage in his notebook enumerating the obstacles to passing desperately needed railroad regulation. While it was certainly possible that some legislators were paid by corporations to oppose unwanted bills, congressional failure to address the disease was more complex. In recent years, the country had witnessed an enormous industrial development, marked by the growth of railroads, trusts, and inventions. While these unprecedented changes required new thinking about the relationship of business and government, Baker reasoned, a legislative lag clearly existed. Laws generated 50 years earlier, rooted in laissez-faire philosophy, remained on the books. Once let an idea really penetrate the mind of a people, as this ethic of non-interference in private enterprise had done, and it would require a massive educational effort to remove it. If he and his fellow journalists could enable the public to re-envision the role of government, Baker noted, there would be no further difficulty in regulating the trusts and the railroads. Encouraging a new way of thinking, however, demanded time and hard work, and Baker was still in the early phase of his research when Congress took up the question of railroad regulation during its short session in the winter of 1905. An administration-backed bill granting the ICC power to regulate railroad rates passed the House, but the Senate deliberately scheduled its hearings after Congress had adjourned on March 3rd, ending any chance for the legislation to pass. Assessing his defeat, Roosevelt concluded that his influence had been stunted. Once he relinquished the chance to run for a third term, the opposition concluded he need not be regarded as a factor hereafter. Still, he believed that if the necessity for regulation could be clearly drawn in the months ahead, the Senate would eventually bow to public feeling. Sentiment did indeed begin to shift, but not in the direction Roosevelt desired. Troubled by the passage of the regulatory bill in the House, the railroads launched a sweeping propaganda campaign to turn the country against regulation. Lengthy hearings before the Senate Interstate Commerce Committee provided the opening salvo. Organized by senators sympathetic to the railroads, the six-week proceeding featured a witness list stacked to thwart regulatory efforts. Over two-thirds of the witnesses, one reporter noted, were either friendly toward or in fear of the railroads and testified accordingly. One after another railroad executives argued that Roosevelt's bill was misguided at best and unconstitutional at worst. They pointed out how delicate and difficult a task it was to adjust a freight rate, how it required long practical experience, intimating that disaster would follow if the government should meddle in the complex business. Any tinkering with rates would raise Cain with stocks, one railway head warned. It would mean a general unsettling of affairs. Forced to travel to Washington at their own expense, the few witnesses who spoke in favor of regulation were mocked and labeled as agitators. Railroad King James J. Hill likened the commotion over regulation to an attack of pink eye or the grip, which would eventually run its course. Members of the Senate committee did nothing to stop such belittling attacks. Congressmen who had voted for Roosevelt's bill in the House were blacklisted from receiving any further free passes. Not surprisingly, newspapermen attending the hearings were influenced by the strength of the opposition, and the national coverage soon turned sharply negative. A prominent Republican senator claimed that the president was looking for a way out, that he had finally realized his ill-considered foray into this arena might throw the country into a panic. To counter rumors that he had ceded the possibility of reform, Roosevelt dispatched Taft to a conference of 300 railway executives meeting at the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. Vehemently reinforcing the administration's commitment to regulation, Taft spoke of the certain advent of railway rate legislation, warning that if the railway men of the country were wise, they would aid and not hinder it. The industry must recognize, he insisted, that railroads are a public institution, an institution which must be regulated by law. You cannot run the railroads as you would run a private business. You must respond to the public demand. Taft's words were greeted with absolute silence until Stuyvesant Fish, president of the Railway Congress, jumped to his feet and exhaustively countered Taft's arguments. The laws already on the books were sufficient to deal with any difficulties, he insisted, declaring that the action proposed would cause more harm than good. When he took his seat amid great applause, Taft respectfully asked, May I have 15 minutes to reply? His rebuttal rendered an even more forceful defense of the necessity for a tribunal with powers to revise unfair rates. Taft's words, driven directly into the ears of the men who are most determined that there shall be no railroad legislation, created a sensation. Observers understood that the Secretary's address had been carefully prepared, and prepared with the intention of causing exactly the impression that was caused. The following day, Roosevelt endorsed Taft's speech by flatly stating that his own stance on the subject of the railroads could not have been better expressed. Railroad magnates needed to understand, he argued, that it was essential in the interests of the public that the government assume a regulatory power over them. Furthermore, he vowed that if this power were awarded, it would be exercised with justice to both the captains of industry and the American people. Roosevelt repeatedly stressed that the spirit of demagoguery must not dictate legislative policy. If we attack unjustly the proper rights of others because they are wealthy, he was careful to maintain, we shall do ourselves just as much damage as if we permitted an attack upon those who are poor because they are poor. He recognized that the rock of class hatred was the greatest and most dangerous rock in the course of any republic. But the time for action had come. If Congress refused to advance the administration's moderate proposal, more radical demands would inevitably gain momentum. Convinced now of the president's resolve, editorials predicted a fight to the finish between the railroads and the administration. Nonetheless, the Washington Post reported, an impression prevailed during the summer that the railroad interests were making such a campaign that there was very grave doubt of any legislation of that character passing in the coming Congress. By summer's end, Baker had completed his research and commenced writing a 6-part, 50,000-word series entitled Railroads on Trial. To herald the upcoming articles, McClure published a lengthy editorial claiming that the vitality of democracy depended on popular knowledge of complex questions. With regulatory legislation that would impact the entire nation under debate in Congress, the public needed to understand how railroads determine differential rates, whether they conspire to stifle competition, how goods were classified, and how private cars and midnight tariffs operated. The American people, not economists and sociologists, would ultimately have to assess whether a few great men, like the barons of old, had become more powerful than the sovereign himself. Mindful of the president's earlier request to peruse his railroad articles before publication, Baker wrote in early September to ask if Roosevelt still wanted to review his first installment, scheduled to appear in the November issue. "Yes, I should greatly like to see the proof," Roosevelt assured him the very next day. "I have learned to look to your articles for real help. You have impressed me with your earnest desire to be fair, with your freedom from hysteria, and with your anxiety to tell the truth." Baker later recalled his trepidation after sending off the piece, aware that the president's approval might be the measure of the usefulness of the entire series he had planned. If Roosevelt found his arguments compelling, Baker could employ the incomparable sounding board of the White House in his endeavor to educate the public. 5 days later, Baker was elated and much relieved by Roosevelt's response. "I haven't a criticism to suggest." "Indeed," the president graciously acknowledged, "you have given me 2 or 3 thoughts for my own message." In clear, powerful language, Baker explained how, despite the Elkins Act that barred cash rebates, the railroads still managed to build in special rates. They had devised a schedule that favored products carried by the trusts through clever classification of goods and commodities. In the early days of the railroad, Baker pointed out, the rate was fixed exactly as it was on a turnpike, a regular toll, for so many miles, so much of a charge. As railroads had begun to consolidate, however, the small circle of controlling owners had adopted the principle of charging what the traffic will bear, providing preferential treatment to the trusts while forcing exorbitant rates on small shippers. When great clients like the Armors, the Rockefellers, or the Morgans desired special privileges, they were easily arranged, given that such families generally sat on the boards of these very same railroads. While the fundamental purpose of all law, Baker argued, is to do justice between strong and weak, between large and small. The railroads and the trusts had conspired to build up and enforce the old favoritism to the strong. For the first time, Baker boldly suggested that railroad rates had become the fulcrum of a new political contest that set a progressive party seeking to give the government more power in business affairs against a conservative party striving to retain all the power possible in private hands. Thanking the president for reviewing his proofs, Baker took the occasion to warn Roosevelt that the mood in the Midwest had become highly volatile. Failure to pass regulatory legislation, he predicted, would foment violent agitation and calls for radical action. The country was never at a more critical point in its career, the reporter observed, nor that it ever had a better opportunity of handling its problem correctly. I wish, Mr. President, and you will pardon my freedom, that there were a Taft for the Bureau of Commerce and Labor. To my thinking, there is no more important place now in the gift of the government. A few weeks later, Baker was amazed to receive a letter from the president containing a strictly confidential partial draft from Roosevelt's annual message dealing with the corporations. Will you give me any comments, the president asked, which your experiences teach you ought to be made thereon? In 8 weeks, the president would deliver his State of the Union speech, and Baker reflected solemnly upon the seriousness of the responsibility granted him. I knew perfectly well how little I really knew about the complicated problems involved in the new legislation, he later wrote. But then, who was there at that time who did? The reporter carefully weighed Roosevelt's language. Heartened by the president's willingness to make railroad regulation his first priority, he found the tone of the draft message disappointing. It was too general. There was too much of the president's favorite balancing of good and evil. Baker applauded Roosevelt's drive to empower the Interstate Commerce Commission to revise disputed freight rates, but deplored his proposal to limit the commission's authority to merely prescribing a maximum rate limit. I was terribly afraid that he was plumping for a solution that, while it might help a little and look good politically, would fail to reach the heart of the matter, Baker recalled. The research for Baker's second article, which detailed all manner of new rebate chicanery, had convinced him that the trusts didn't care what the rate was, so long as they enjoyed a better rate than everyone else. The differential provided their advantage and allowed them to crush their competitors. Beyond their clever freight classification schemes, railroads had implemented a host of cunning devices, including private cars, refrigerator charges, elevator allowances, underweighing of freight, and variable tariffs. Such measures were specifically designed to lower rates for the great shippers in beef, oil, and steel, while raising them for the farmer, the small struggling manufacturers, and shippers. Believing he had gained a comprehensive understanding of the railroad conspiracy, Baker felt compelled to tell the president plainly that his approach was misguided. I have asked myself over and over, Baker wrote to Roosevelt on November 11th, expressing his doubts, whether the power to fix a maximum rate which you suggest will touch this specific case of injustice. He had determined that it would not. The evil power of the trusts, he explained, lay in their ability to compel the railroads to give them a lower rate than everyone else. The problem, therefore, was not a maximum rate, but a minimum rate. The only solution was to allow the government tribunal to fix a definite rate. Roosevelt replied immediately, agreeing that it would be better if the commission had the power to fix a definite instead of a maximum rate. His attorney general had warned him, however, that fixing a definite rate might be unconstitutional. While the maximum rate might not alleviate all problems, he concluded, we should have first a law that is surely constitutional. Baker persisted, reiterating in a second letter that merely limiting the maximum rate would not mitigate the terrible inequity in the entire system. Is there not, then, some practical way, he entreated, for reaching the real abuse? Quoting the abolitionist Wendell Phillips' remark on historic reforms, Baker challenged the president's objection. If they do not succeed with the Constitution, then they must succeed without it. There followed a long and rather heated correspondence between the two men, spurred by a 4-page letter from the president. I think you are entirely mistaken in your depreciation of what is accomplished by fixing a maximum rate, Roosevelt declared, arguing that the insistence upon having only the perfect cure often results in securing no betterment whatever. Furthermore, he added, the railroads have been crazy in their hostility to my maximum rate proposition, and evidently do not share in the least your belief that nothing will result from it. In additional exchanges, Roosevelt branded Baker's continued fear that the proposed measure would prove insufficient simply absurd. He ended the correspondence with a reminder that it was Lincoln, not Wendell Phillips and the fanatical abolitionists, who was the effective champion of union and freedom. Confronted by Roosevelt's strident tone, Baker was certain that his suggestion would come to nothing. What was my surprise, Baker later recalled, when I read the message in its final form as delivered to Congress, to find that the President had inserted a paragraph, almost in my own words, regarding the regulation of minimum rates. After calling upon Congress to grant an impartial tribunal authority to set a maximum reasonable rate when a given rate was deemed unreasonable and unjust, Roosevelt laid out a far more comprehensive proposal. It sometimes happens at present, not that a rate is too high, but that a favored shipper is given too low a rate. In such cases, the Commission would have the right to fix this already established minimum rate as the maximum, and it would need only one or two such decisions by the Commission to cure railroad companies of the practice of giving improper minimum rates. Finally, he urged Congress to grant the ICC supervision of private car lines, elevator allowances, refrigerator charges, and industrial roads, all the devices Baker had exposed as subtle mechanisms of discrimination. On January 4, 1906, Colonel William Hepburn, chairman of the Interstate and Foreign Commerce Committee, reported the administration-backed railroad bill to the floor of the House. As Roosevelt had outlined in his annual message, the bill gave the ICC the authority to determine a just and reasonable maximum for disputed rates. While it was essentially a moderate bill, it nonetheless challenged the most hoary tenet of free private enterprise, the right to independently set prices according to supply and demand. While Speaker Joseph Cannon could have easily exercised his absolute control over House procedure to prevent the bill from reaching the floor, he had allowed it to move forward. In exchange, the President had agreed to preserve the protective tariff, an issue the old guard considered more vital than railroad regulation. Popular resentment towards the railroads was such that once the bill reached the floor, the outcome was clear. The overwhelming vote to pass the Hepburn bill on February 8th was, in many ways, the most spectacular piece of politics ever witnessed at the Capitol, the Washington Post remarked, noting that a bill vitally affecting over $15 billion of property had passed without the addition of a single amendment. The following day, Roosevelt invited Ray Baker to join him during his afternoon shave. Baker professed his belief that this railroad legislation was the most important of the President's administration, but only a first step toward broader reform. Investigations throughout the West had convinced the journalists that the public was moving beyond the President's position, even pushing for governmental ownership of the railroad. Roosevelt vehemently disagreed, twisting so abruptly toward Baker that the barber had to flinch quickly to avoid cutting the President's chin. "I do not represent public opinion. I represent the public," Roosevelt passionately countered, insisting, "I must represent not the excited opinion of the West, but the real interests of the whole people." "Those interests would be ill-served," he curtly rejoined, "by turning the operation of the railroads over to government employees, for he knew better than anyone else could how inefficient and undependable they were." The Hepburn bill, Roosevelt insisted, would address most of the problems. Rather than speculate on future steps, he must focus on the United States Senate, where he faced perhaps the climactic struggle of his administration. A battle royale was predicted between the President and the conservative senators, led by Nelson Aldrich. While public pressure precluded an outright assault on the bill, Aldrich and his colleagues remained confident they could produce a final bill so whittled down by amendments as to be practically worthless. Roosevelt was clearly prepared for such tactics. "They are making every effort to have some seemingly innocent amendment put in," he explained, "which shall destroy something of what I am endeavoring to accomplish." To forestall these inevitable efforts to gut the bill, Roosevelt declared unequivocally that he wished the Senate to pass the Hepburn bill without amendments. His statement produced great indignation among the conservative senators. The chief executive, they insisted, had no business meddling in their deliberations. His presumptuous intervention showed a woeful disregard of the Senate's historic role as a check upon the half-baked and demagogic bills passed by the lower house. Roosevelt's push to get the bill unamended through the Senate Interstate Commerce Committee rested on the leadership of Iowa's junior senator, Jonathan Dolliver. A young progressive, Dolliver worked doggedly to produce a majority vote and deliver what would become the Dolliver-Hepburn bill to the floor. Of the 8 Republicans, he won the support of 3, all from the West, where agitation for railroad control was most intense. Combined with 5 Democrats, who had long favored regulatory control, they formed the slim majority Dolliver needed to bring the bill to the floor. Conceding that he had lost in committee, Aldrich deftly contrived a deal with the Democrats. He would give Benjamin Tillman, the ranking Democrat from South Carolina, the honor of leading the fight on the floor in Dolliver's place. In turn, Democrats agreed to report the unamended bill without prejudice, thereby allowing amendments to be freely offered during debate on the floor. This gambit astonished even the most seasoned journalists. The fact that Roosevelt's most outspoken opponent was put in charge of the administration's pet measure, one Ohio paper remarked, was considered so audacious a piece of irony that it has made the country gasp. Fully aware that Republicans controlled nearly 2/3 of the Senate, Tillman himself scarcely had time to pinch himself to see if he were really awake. The loyal Dolliver, who had justifiably assumed he would lead the fight, was humiliated. Worse still, the president confronted a truly awkward dilemma. During Roosevelt's first term, the hot-tempered, foul-mouthed, and slovenly Tillman, known as Pitchfork Ben, had engaged in a fistfight with a colleague on the Senate floor. In the aftermath, Roosevelt had publicly withdrawn Tillman's invitation to a state dinner, incurring the senator's abiding animosity. The two men had not spoken since. Aldrich calculated that with the irascible Tillman as floor leader, Roosevelt's influence on the legislative process would be severely diminished. The press agreed. Roosevelt now suffered the indignity, declared the Charleston News, of seeing his signal legislation confided to the care of a man who is not only not of his own party, but one who entertains a personal antagonism toward him. The president's old enemies in the Republican Party, the Indianapolis News observed, seemed determined not only to defeat his legislation, but also to show at the same time that the president is not, after all, a formidable figure. In the following weeks, pro-railroad Republicans took to the floor, proposing a range of amendments designed to shatter the commission's authority. They were particularly intent upon a provision granting the courts broad power to relitigate the commission's revised rates, essentially leaving the pro-railroad judiciary as the true arbiter of rates. Roosevelt nevertheless remained hopeful that the Hepburn bill would emerge intact, trusting that public opinion may be relied upon to keep the Senate straight. By the spring of 1906, public outrage over the railroads had indeed reached a crescendo. Hundreds of magazines and newspapers followed every aspect of the debate, clearly outlining what was at stake. These publications, one editorialist observed, were never better and never more influential than in their joint effort to foster an informed public opinion, compounded of knowledge, discrimination, and judgment. In March, Baker published the most consequential piece in his railroad series, an exposé of the techniques the railroads employed to malign and falsify the Hepburn Bill. Acknowledging the right of the railroads, in common with all other citizens, to present facts and arguments to the people, Baker proceeded to reveal the multifarious devices of the railroad's lavishly funded propaganda campaign. A team of agents determined whether newspaper editors were good or bad on the issue of the railroads, then distributed free passes to those adjudged favorably inclined, while subjecting those deemed unfriendly to underhanded personal attacks. In one instance, a former city newspaper man was hired to write a pamphlet posing as a representative of farmers against regulation. In another scheme, small newspapers were supplied with free reading supplements, seeded with a tax on Roosevelt's railroad legislation. Subsidized pamphlets spread the rumor that if railroad discriminations were outlawed, separate Jim Crow cars for Negroes would be forbidden. If all such ordinary devices to co-opt the press failed, then the railroads purchased newspapers outright. Baker's description of this onslaught of covert railroad propaganda acquainted more than 500,000 men and women with the true methods of the anti-regulatory campaign. "It is a little startling," one magazine editorialized, "to read how the railroad combines first to rob the country of millions, and then to use a portion of this fund stolen from the people to corrupt the sources of information and thus to perpetuate their robbery through a blinded public opinion." New subscriptions and letters commending Baker poured into McClure's. A Mississippi farmer wrote that, after plowing all day, he and his boys had read the entire piece aloud. If he had the funds, he told Baker, he would send a copy to every family in the country. "Every member of Congress," he added, "should have a chance to read this able presentation of the question between the people and the railroads." One Wisconsin resident told McClure's that he considered Baker's article worth all the publication will cost me for next 10 years. The sensational article heightened public demand for regulation, much as the publication of the Standard Oil telegrams had done during the battle over the Bureau of Corporations. To the dismay of Senator Aldrich, who had counted on Roosevelt's pride to prevent any overture to the man he loathed, the president soon made it clear that he was, of course, entirely willing to see Mr. Tillman personally, or meet with any other party empowered to act on Tillman's behalf. "I do not care a rap about Mr. Tillman's getting credit for the bill, or having charge of it," he later recalled. "I was delighted to go with him, or anyone else, just so long as he was traveling my way." Still unwilling to set foot in the White House, Tillman asked former Senator William E. Chandler to serve as intermediary. After a series of White House sessions with Chandler, Roosevelt agreed to support a Tillman-endorsed amendment that limited judicial review to a simple determination of whether the Commission's rate revision procedures were fair. By moving to the left of his original position, the president hoped to fashion a majority compromising both Republican progressives and Democratic populists. "The fight on the rate bill is growing hot," Roosevelt told Kermit, explaining his ongoing efforts to save it. "I am now trying to see if I cannot get it through in the form I want by the aid of some 15 or 20 Republicans added to most of the Democrats." As for Tillman, William Allen White wrote in the Emporia Gazette, "No member of the president's own party could have pressed the bill more vigorously at all times. He demanded that all other state business be stopped until a rate bill was passed, and he kept the Senate an hour earlier and an hour later than it was accustomed to sit. Handed the greatest responsibility of his career, Benjamin Tillman had determined, he said, to pocket my pride and lay aside my just indignation in order to aid the president in securing a good railroad law." No better illustration of the mysterious ways of Providence and politics could be found, the Washington Post commented, than the alliance of the pitchfork and the big stick. Roosevelt would gladly have signed Tillman's more radical revision of the Hepburn bill if his new coalition of progressive Republicans and Democrats had produced sufficient numbers to override the conservative Republican bloc. But in the end, a number of Southern senators balked, deeming the bill a violation of states' rights, and Tillman could not deliver enough Democratic votes to make it work. Roosevelt was left with no choice but to revert to the original Hepburn bill, which had simply assumed the constitutional guarantee of due process. Despite such setbacks, Roosevelt remained satisfied with this formulation. The great object, he insisted, was to avoid the adoption of any of the broad amendments. To forge a majority on the original bill, however, he would have to mollify moderate Republicans who feared that unless the courts were directly vested with judicial review, the bill might be held unconstitutional. To win over this reluctant bloc, Roosevelt called on two old guard senators, William Allison of Iowa and John Spooner of Wisconsin. Both had long been staunch lieutenants to Nelson Aldrich, and both were assumed to be supporters of his bid to emasculate the bill. The political landscape was shifting, however. In Iowa and Wisconsin, the momentum to regulate the railroads had reached a frantic pitch, and the two senators understood that ignoring their constituents on this issue would put their Senate seats in grave jeopardy. Allison and Spooner's unexpected cooperation with Roosevelt made headlines. Two of the original Big Four, this little knot of men, had ruled the upper branch in harmony for years. Nelson Aldrich found the break with Allison especially painful, for he relied upon Allison's masterful knowledge of parliamentary procedure. Everybody is now watching with eagerness to see which of the two great Senate chieftains will demonstrate superior generalship, commented the New York Times. From his post at the Emporia Gazette, William Allen White noted that Aldrich appeared befuddled on the fact that he could neither control the legislation of the upper branch affecting financial interests, nor count upon the men he regarded as allies. This rupture in the Senate oligarchy was widely regarded as symbolic of the new popular alignment all over the country in preparation for the coming contest between the forces of amalgamated capital and those of popular will and sentiment. Straight away, Allison devoted himself to fashioning his own amendment to the Hepburn Bill, which stipulated the right to judicial review of ICC rulings, but cleverly leaving the scope of that review undetermined. The ambiguous language of the Allison Amendment allowed the senator to forge a majority. While Roosevelt had hoped to limit the court's review to a determination of procedural fairness, he recognized that this compromise provided the only chance of passage. Once the amendment was accepted, Roosevelt later told White, Aldrich and his people really threw up their hands. Their chance to obtain a broad review provision had been eliminated. Indeed, when the Hepburn Bill finally reached the Senate floor for a vote, Aldrich and a number of his older colleagues were noticeably absent. The bill passed by an overwhelming vote. No given measure and no given set of measures will work a perfect cure for any serious evil, Roosevelt reminded critics of the compromised bill. Though flawed, the president maintained that the Hepburn Act represented the longest step ever yet taken in the direction of solving the railway rate problem. The legislation not only brought the railroads under federal control, it lifted the idea of nationality to a point never before reached. The authority granted the Interstate Commerce Commission became clearer in the months that followed, as the first case involving rate revision reached the Supreme Court. By declining to review the specific facts, the High Court defined the scope of judicial review in favor of Roosevelt and the progressives. The president enjoyed widespread credit for the passage of the bill, exhibiting, one Democratic newspaper remarked, the politician's gift of knowing when to fight and, as well, when to surrender. Roosevelt had sought a Republican majority for the original Hepburn Bill. When his efforts were subverted by the leader of his own party, he had reached out to the Democrats. When that failed to produce a majority, he returned to his original provision, altered only slightly by Allison's amendment. Even Benjamin Tillman grudgingly acknowledged that, but for the work of Theodore Roosevelt, we would not have had any bill at all. However astute Roosevelt proved in dealing with Congress, he would doubtless have failed to secure a meaningful bill without a galvanized public behind him. The combined efforts of Baker and his fellow journalists had generated a widespread demand for reform. Congress might ignore a president, the Weekly Sentinel observed, but could not ignore a president and the people. A letter discovered among Baker's papers testifies to the impact of investigative journalism on the passage of the Hepburn Bill. It is through writers like yourself, Mr. Steffens and Miss Tarbell, that the country as a whole is beginning to understand. In the future, your influence on the life of the Republic will be held to be greater than that of the men who now rule our Senate and our House. Baker reflected on their accomplishments and his growing confidence in the nation's future in a letter to his father. This crusade against special privilege in high places is real war, a real revolution, he wrote. We may not have to go as far as you did when you fought out the slavery question with powder and blood. At the present, when any of us is wounded, we bleed nothing but ink. But ink may serve the purpose. Upton Sinclair, the young novelist and friend of Ray Baker and Lincoln Steffens, helped investigate the next battle in the crusade against special privilege. Sinclair highly esteemed the dramatic factual stories in McClure's that mobilized public opinion. but reproached his comrades for failing to endorse the panacea of socialism. At the age of 24, Sinclair had concluded with certainty that socialism was the answer to the country's ills. His experience of reading a socialist pamphlet in 1902, he later said, was like the falling down of prison walls about my mind. Thus, unlike the members of the McClure team, Sinclair was not struggling to discover remedies for specific ills. "Perhaps it'll surprise you," he wrote to Baker during the railroad struggle, "but we socialists don't agree with your rebate agony. The quicker the concentration of wealth is completed, the better it suits us. The point all you reforming folks seem to miss is that you are locking the stable doors after the horse is gone. The trusts are formed. The big shipper has got the money. Also, with the money, he's bought the government." At 25, Sinclair had already published two obscure novels when the editor of a popular socialist weekly, Appeal to Reason, offered to pay $500 for the right to publish his next fiction project in serial form. He quickly chose The Wage Slavery of Industrial-Era Workers as his next subject. The young socialist decided to set his novel in the Chicago stockyards, where an unsuccessful strike by workers in the meatpacking plants had aroused his sympathy. Dazzled by the brilliance of Frank Norris and a small cadre of writers devoted to realism, Sinclair took up residence in Packingtown, the stockyard district. "For 7 weeks," he recalled, "I sat at night in the homes of the workers, foreign-born and native, and they told me their stories, one after one, and I made notes of everything," he recalled. Wandering around the yards during the day, Sinclair noted, "I was not much better dressed than the workers, and found that by the simple device of carrying a dinner pail I could go anywhere." Passing into rancid, hazardous places that outsiders rarely frequented, he watched with amazement as scraps of meat that were later sold to the public were swept from floors. During the day, Sinclair noted, "I was not much better dressed than the workers, and found that by the simple device of carrying a dinner pail I could go anywhere." The pressure to produce profits dictated that nothing was allowed to go to waste. Condemned hogs were rendered into lard. Moldy meats were dosed with borax and ground into sausage. Spoiled hams were pumped with chemicals to mask the smell, so bad that a man could hardly bear to be in the room with them. After a month of watchfulness, Sinclair had collected the data, but not yet conceived the protagonists for his novel. One Sunday afternoon, he chanced to attend the rollicking traditional wedding celebration of a young Lithuanian couple. Standing transfixed with his back to a wall as the festivities unfolded around him, Sinclair found his characters amid the whirl of music and dance. The bride, the groom, the old mother and father, the boisterous cousin, the children, the three musicians, everybody. The Jungle tells the story of the young couple and their extended family as they emigrate to Chicago in pursuit of plentiful jobs, decent wages, and the fulfillment of the American dream. No one subscribes more completely to the idea that decency and hard work will earn a place in America than the central character, Jurgis Rudkus. Confident in his ferocious strength and determination to provide for his family, Jurgis immediately lands a job. He is the sort of man the bosses like to get hold of. When he is told to go a certain place, he would go there on a run. When he had nothing to do for the moment, he would stand around fidgeting, dancing with the overflow of energy that was in him. Filled with optimism, Jurgis saves every cent to buy a home for his wife and children. He would work all day, Sinclair wrote, and all night too, if need be. He would never rest until the house was paid for and his people had a home. Before long, the predatory machine of Packingtown begins to corrode his optimism and assurance. For years, glib salesmen had counted upon the ignorance of the immigrants. If a single payment was missed, the house was lost, along with everything paid into it. Indeed, Sinclair observed, the houses were sold with the idea that the people who bought them would not be able to pay for them. The unscrupulous salesman could always count on a new wave of immigrants, clamoring desperately for jobs and needful of food and housing. The meatpacking plants grind up workers as surely as they grind up hogs and cattle. Sinclair details the brutal hours of work with no compensation for injury and little hope of evading the disease's legion in unsanitary surroundings. During the holiday speeding up on the slaughtering floor, Jurgis is hurt. Finally able to return to work, he discovers that his job has been given to another man. Once fresh and strong, Jurgis becomes a damaged article his bosses no longer want. At once vividly individual and representative of an entire beleaguered class, Sinclair's characters are callously denied any real hope of a livelihood or future. The devastation of the entire family has been set in motion, their tragedy engendered not through personal failure, but through the savage capitalist system that pits man against man. When his young wife and then his son die, Jurgis is crushed in body and spirit. Finding himself at a socialist rally, he is at last spiritually reborn, awakened to revolution. After five publishers rejected Sinclair's manuscript outright, Doubleday finally considered publication. The revelations in this story were so astounding, the New York Times reported, that the publishers commissioned a lawyer to go to Chicago to make a personal investigation of the author's representations. When the attorney's report corroborated Sinclair, Doubleday agreed to move forward. In February 1906, as he nervously awaited official publication, Sinclair sent two advance copies to Ray Baker. One was autographed to the journalist. The second, Sinclair hoped, Baker might deliver to the White House and present to President Roosevelt. The book created an immediate sensation. While some reviews criticized the contrived socialist epiphany of the ending, millions of readers found Sinclair's cast of characters and the grotesque details of the meatpacking industry compelling. "Not since Byron awoke one morning to find himself famous," observed the New York Evening World, "has there been such an example of worldwide fame won in a day by a book as has come to Upton Sinclair." James Garfield was the first in the White House to read the book. Hideous, he termed the story, but not more so than the place, which he had visited during the Bureau of Corporation's investigation of the Beef Trust. Sinclair, he wrote in his journal, had produced a terrible and, I fear, too true account of the lives of many miserable men and women among the working class in our big cities. During a long walk with the president, Garfield described at length his reaction to the book. Intrigued by Garfield's reaction, Roosevelt completed the novel and invited the novelist to the White House during the first week in April. Although he proceeded to disparage the socialist's diatribe tacked on to the book's conclusion, Roosevelt assured Sinclair that "all this has nothing to do with the fact that the specific evils you point out shall, if their existence be proved, and I have power, be eradicated." By the time Sinclair arrived for lunch on April 4th, a Department of Agriculture investigator was en route to the stockyards with an order from the White House to evaluate the novelist's charges. "Sending a representative of the very agency that had failed properly to inspect the plants," Sinclair objected, "was like asking a burglar to determine his own guilt." His objections prompted Roosevelt to dispatch two additional investigators with no official ties to the department. He chose two well-respected men, Commissioner of Labor Charles P. Neal and Assistant Secretary of the Treasury James Bronson Reynolds. Sinclair was delighted, though he feared the investigators would focus on the diseased meats rather than the working conditions in the yard. "I have power to deal with one and not with the other," Roosevelt responded. With the investigation underway, the Chicago Tribune ran a series of articles citing, on excellent authority, that the president's team had already debunked the overwhelming majority of Sinclair's charges and claiming that Roosevelt intended to castigate the novelist in an upcoming speech. In a state of panic, Sinclair barraged the president with letters, a telegram, and a phone call. Roosevelt patiently explained that the newspaper story was simply fabricated. "It is absurd to become so nervous over such an article," he admonished the novelist. "Hundreds such appear about me all the time, with quite as little foundation." Chastened, Sinclair maintained that he should never have dreamed of writing, except it seemed incomprehensible that a journalist with a reputation to protect would dare to disseminate false information in such an explicit and positive way. Roosevelt immediately assuaged Sinclair's anxiety. "I understand entirely how you felt. Of course, you have not had the experience I have had with newspapers. Meanwhile, we will go steadily ahead with the investigation. In fact, Roosevelt's inspectors found stockyard conditions comparable to those Sinclair had portrayed.